LL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2005-2006 season opens with a community party on September 10th featuring music by Breakestra, the world premiere of The End of Cinematics by Michael Rouse, and the four-day wall-to-wall guitar festival. Visit KrannertCenter.com for information on the entire season. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Sea Boat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Sea Boat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Sea Boat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. Domestic violence affects people from all walks of life, all ages, incomes, and religions. More than 1,000 women die each year at the hands of abusers. Children and other family members are also victimized. On the program today, Addressing Domestic Violence, three guests join us this afternoon. Joining us by telephone is a journalist who writes on criminal and social justice. Her name is Sarah Catania, and she is the author of an article on domestic violence, The Counselor, that appeared in the July-August issue of Mother Jones magazine. Susan Chapin and Ellen Schweitzer are here with me in the studio. Susan is the domestic violence coordinator in the office of the Champaign County State's Attorney. Ellen Schweitzer is a medical advocate with A Woman's Place, a shelter in Champaign-Urbana. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, first, let me give a shout-out to Sarah, who's joining us on the telephone this afternoon. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Celeste.
Sure. And Susan and Ellen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Sarah, I'd like to begin with you and the article that you wrote for Mother Jones, The Counselor. It opens with the death of a woman who the counselor, Patty Prickett, said did everything right, but the system didn't. Tell us what happened.
Yes, this story that Patty Prickett, the counselor, told me is about a woman whom she tried to help. She was The counselor, Patty Prickett, was working with the LAPD out of one of their station houses, the one in West Los Angeles. And a woman reported that she had been having problems with her estranged husband. Patty Prickett urged her to leave him, and she did. She took the kids with her. She took them to a shelter, but they felt very isolated there, so they left the shelter. Her husband tracked them down and repeatedly violated a restraining order that she had taken out against him until ultimately he did track her down, the mother, and killed her. And the children, Patty Prickett had the unfortunate task of, you know, looking after the children and telling them about the death, and soon thereafter, she actually left that station house because she felt that the police had not responded appropriately to this woman's complaints, and every time that she came, she would come in and tell the police that he had violated the restraining order. The advocate, Patty Prickett, felt that the police did not respond appropriately, that they did not take aggressive action against the perpetrator, and that this, according to Patty Prickett, led to this woman being tracked down by her former spouse and killed. And he is still at large, by the way.
How effective are restraining orders?
Well, I think that really varies, and I think that was one of the points in that story. The story, as I write in the piece, this particular case had many similarities to one that went before the U.S. Supreme Court this summer. a case called Castle Rock versus Gonzalez, in which a woman had a restraining order against her spouse. It was violated, and he ended up killing their two children. In that case, obviously, the restraining order was not effective. The police did not respond to her pleas for them to enforce the restraining order. But it really varies. Advocates that I talked to from around the country said that it really depends a lot on the community and the commitment made by that community to make domestic violence, enforcement of domestic violence laws, a priority. And I'm sure that Susan Chapin can talk about that. If you have police and prosecutors and probation officers and judges who take domestic violence seriously, you're going to see a real decline in domestic violence cases and homicides related to domestic violence. In communities where it's not taken as seriously, where it's not considered as much of a priority, you're going to see those numbers go up.
Well, let's turn now to Susan Chapin of the State's Attorney's Office. First of all, talk with us, if you would, about the restraining order and what we have in Illinois, the order of protection.
Most of our victims get what's called an order of protection in the state. First, they go to court and they get an emergency order of protection, which gives them protection for 14 to 21 days. At that time, there is a second hearing set that's called the plenary hearing. The respondent in that case has to be served with a copy of the verified petition and a summons with the next hearing date on that. At that second hearing, the respondent has the right to be there, has the right to contest the two-year order being entered, and has the right to have counsel.
How effective of a tool is the order of protection in Champaign County?
I feel the response in Champaign County by law enforcement and the state's attorney's office and the judges alike is exceptional. I think that has evolved over the last several years. And what we tell victims is, you know, it is a piece of paper. In order for us to enforce a violation, it has to be reported to the police.
Ellen, you want to jump in here? Ellen Schweitzer from A Woman's Place.
I think a lot of the difficulties with the orders of protection lie with the fact that these women, so many of them I have worked with, clients of the shelter, they see this as a first line of defense, and it's a huge step for them to even get to the point where they say, I want to get something to help me. I think it's time something needs to be done. And I think a lot of times they get disheartened when these orders of protection are violated, and they feel, you know, this was issued from a judge. Why is this not being respected? They don't understand the system. They feel it's working against them, and they feel that they've been violated a second time beyond their abuser.
Yeah. How often, Susan, are they violated?
I would say that quite frequently they are violated, much more frequently than what gets reported.
Meaning reported?
It has to be reported to the police in order for it to be enforced. If the violation is taking place and the victim slash petitioner is not reporting it, then no one knows.
Sarah Catania, what kind of consequences do people who violate either a restraining order or an order of protection face?
Well, that varies from place to place. I think for your area, Susan Chapin might be able to answer that better. But I, before you get to that, I did want to add to something that Ellen had said about women taking this big step of going to get a protection order, sort of acknowledging, first of all, that they are being victimized by domestic violence, and then involving the courts, involving, you know, taking legal action to seek protection for themselves. But then, you know, as Susan Chapin pointed out, often when the protection orders are violated, they are not reported because obviously we're talking about a situation where a woman then has to go back to the police and tell them that it's been violated each time it happens. And that's a difficult thing to do, and that might be something that Ellen could talk more about. But regarding the kinds of consequences that violators face. It's particularly in your area, probably Susan Chapin could better answer that.
Yeah, Susan?
The first violation is actually a Class A misdemeanor, punishable by a maximum of 364 days in the county jail. Most generally, they do not receive that much punishment. If there has been a domestic battery conviction prior to the violation of the order of protection, then that is a felony. So then the consequences get greater as we go on.
Yeah. And Ellen, jump in here about the difficulty for women to keep. The burden is on them.
Mm-hmm, exactly. These women are experiencing a myriad of emotions. It's almost a double-edged sword. They love their abuser, but they know they want it to stop, and they will return to them and, say, return back to a shelter, go with a relative, a friend. It's usually on an average from 7 to 10 times. These women are usually pretty hesitant to work with the system, to work with law enforcement, whether it has been a situation with an officer coming out to a domestic call and not having a satisfactory resolution to that. If they've interacted with hospitals and law enforcement in the hospitals, they are extremely hesitant to get involved with them again. Typically, they feel that law enforcement just doesn't want to get involved and they're not going to receive any sort of assistance from them. So it's kind of a push and pull with them. They really don't know where to turn, which is why with the shelter, we just try to start them off. Just, you know, step one, just let's try and see if we can get the order of protection. Let's go from there. But the other problem is if they do violate, if the abuser does violate the order of protection, law enforcement will typically look down upon the woman if she hasn't reported it. But what they're not keeping in mind is that the woman is feeling love for her abuser, and she feels torn. She doesn't know what to do. It's not an issue of right and wrong and what she's doing wrong. So then she struggles with law enforcement, and that's where that comes into play.
Yeah, okay. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us on line one, a caller in Champaign. Let's take that call now. Good afternoon.
Blessings on you all. I want to say I was privileged to work with as an advocate for victims of domestic violence for 3 years, and it's certainly a very mind-expanding and painful experience to be a counselor working with individuals in that situation. And I just wanted to relate something and ask a question. I'm currently involved in a lot of assessments and crisis work, and I meet a lot of people. And probably I would say domestic violence is involved in probably 1 out of 5, 1 out of 7 people you actually see in the emergency room. And what's amazing to me is with my coworkers and other professionals who I respect very much, I mean, these are people I'm very bonded to and respect, the level of minimization that they place upon domestic violence is considerable. It's very common to even hear people when you say, well, but there's emotional violence. I feel this person is being emotionally abused or under some very powerful form of torture and brainwashing. You know, it's very common for counselors to go say things like, well, I didn't think they ever hit them. And they don't understand that, in fact, most domestic violence is very emotional. It's a lot of mind games. And hitting is just part of it in a very minor aspect. So I think people tend to minimize what domestic violence is. But then if the panelists, I just have two things. If you could comment on the role of children in making women vulnerable to domestic violence and how difficult it is to get supervised visitation anywhere in the United States, that's a really important issue. And the second one is for the medical advocate. People who have never been to the shelter perhaps would not understand the role of wellness and illness in domestic violence and how the two are so intertwined and interchangeable. So just a comment and two questions. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Who would like to start? Ellen, you want to start?
To address that question, a lot of the women that we have coming into the shelter have been stripped down to such just a basic shell. When they're in an abusive situation, pretty much everything is taken away from them. They lose the ability to make decisions for themselves, how to take care of themselves financially, emotionally, physically, because their abuser has taken over that role and is trying to pull her away from a normal life so that they can have more control over her. The women I see coming into the shelter, they don't know how to take care of themselves. They don't know how to, you know, address even common issues of just having a cold or how to get a checking account. It ranges from, you know, the small to larger things. And these women just are at such a point where they want it to change, but they don't know where to start. They don't know what resources to use. They don't know what things in the community to utilize to help get them started. It's at a very basic level, and you have to start building them up from where they're at when they come into the shelter.
Yeah, that's got to complicate your efforts at prosecution.
It certainly does. I also want to address the question on children involved in the domestic situations. I would just estimate that probably 80% of the police reports we receive include children in the home. A lot of times they aren't direct witnesses to the abuse, but children are very perceptive. Children know what's going on, even if they're in the other room or they're quote-unquote asleep. So we deal with that issue a lot. This is kind of a catch-22 sometimes for us, is we are mandated reporters. And when we receive police reports that talk about children being in the home, whether they were physically present for the abuse or not, we have to report that to Department of Children and Family Services. So sometimes Department of Children and Family Services then get involved in the lives of the women who are struggling anyway. So this is a very difficult issue for all of us.
Yeah, and now to Sarah.
Yes, Patty, I'd actually like to make a comment on that.
Sure.
As well. In addition to the story that ran in the paper copy of Mother Jones, there is also another piece that I wrote that's available at the Mother Jones website, which is motherjones.com, and it directly addresses the issue of custody, which is related excuse me, to what we're talking about here. When women, if they reach the point in a battering relationship where they decide to get a divorce, if they're married and they want a divorce, and they try to get custody of the kids, if abuse comes up in that context, domestic violence, child abuse, the woman's chances of retaining custody of the children, if it's a contested situation, diminishes to a very large degree. And I'm sure Susan Chapin knows about this. It's related to what she's talking about, because if a woman is in the home where children are witnessing or experiencing violence and the woman has not reported that, she then becomes culpable and is not viewed in a favorable light in the courtroom. So it becomes a very complicated, tragic situation where these women are struggling to, they may struggle for years to try to keep their family together, to try to mend an irreparably damaged relationship with an abuser. But then if they do finally come forward, then they become responsible for that abuse in a way that can lead to separation from their kids.
Mm. Susan Chapin, you're nodding your head.
Yes, failure to protect. We hear that term all the time. When a woman is not capable of caring for herself and protecting herself, it's very difficult for her to care for or protect her children. So that's where we get caught up in that web.
Yeah. We have another listener waiting to talk with us on a cell phone on line one. Hi.
I was wondering if you could talk to the issue of when the child is the abuser. I've got a son who has been abusing his mother for several years. And how do you address that issue?
Ellen?
This is actually something that is much more frequent than people would possibly imagine. When people think of domestic violence, they think spousal abuse. a husband and a wife. It's between those two. They don't also bear in mind that it can be a child abusing a parent, a sibling abusing another sibling. It's such a wide range of people it can involve. We do encounter this a lot with clients we work with. Typically, it will be a woman may have been in a domestic violence situation with her husband who is the abuser or partner who is the abuser. And these children, commenting on what Susan was saying earlier, how they absolutely absorb everything that's going on around them, the cycle of violence will repeat itself. And if, say, a woman loses her spouse or her partner and there's a child still in the residence or still living with her in her life, a lot of times they will replace that role of that abuser and will continue on with the abuse of the parent. It starts at such a young age, and that's why people really need to understand that these children absorb, see, hear everything, and these children are much smarter than we give them credit for. They absolutely know what's going on, and they are learning everything that they are seeing. They're going to repeat it, and that cycle of violence needs to be broken. If it's not broken, it's going to continue on into their children and the children after that.
Well, in this specific situation, that was not the case, and I'm the non-custodial parent of this child, mm-hmm. and I've tried to get the court system to remove him from her environment because she will not, mm-hmm. And the courts, well, he's an adult. He's legally an adult now, so the situation has turned into a much more serious legal matter mm-hmm. than for him. But you're talking about how the legal system, people feel frustrated with that. Well, I've spent numerous times in court trying to at least get the court to remove him from that so she wasn't injured anymore because she wouldn't do it, and I could not get the court to act. I spent 5 years, total frustration, trying to remove him from and not even necessarily in my custody, but to get him away from her to protect her because she wouldn't protect herself.
Boy, what do you do in a situation like this, Susan Chapin?
If this starts out when the abusive person is a minor, then that is one issue. Then when they legally become an adult, then that, of course, is another issue. It's hard to say how this all starts, but I can tell you that the cases we've seen where it's a mother being abused by a child, that, in my opinion, is probably more difficult for that victim to deal with than if it's an intimate partner that she's dealing with. That's her child that she has raised. And I think we have to look into lots of things. We have to look into mental health issues. We have to look into substance abuse issues. The term counseling, I know everybody gets tired of hearing, but sometimes that's where we have to start.
Yeah. Why a failure on the part of the court to act?
Courts can only do so much. And just like in the intimate partner abuse situation, you have a mother who's not willing to testify against a child. And it's very, very difficult to do anything.
Yeah. Sarah Catania, you want
to? Yeah, I'd like to just throw in here a mention of the Violence Against Women Act, which is the sort of omnibus legislation that was the federal act that was first passed about 10 years ago that provided funding for all kinds of programs, regional and community programs, to try to combat domestic violence. And the reason I bring it up right now is because one of the things that the act is up for renewal this fall. It expires at the end of September. And in looking at ways to improve the act, one of the areas that people were really concerned about was education, counseling, programs to address what Alan referred to as the cycle of violence, trying to address it before it starts, to get education out to kids. We're talking about the gentleman who called talked about a child abusing a parent. There's also adolescent abuse, kids in relationships, in abusive relationships at very young ages, teenagers in abusive relationships, mimicking the behavior that they observed. So one of the areas that the Violence Against Women Act is hoping to address with funding and programs in the new cycle are programs that deal with education, that deal with outreach, substance abuse programs, things like that.
Yeah. Let's turn to our two guests in the studio now, to Ellen and to Susan. From your point of view, from where you sit, has the act made a difference?
Absolutely. I do feel that there, you know, could be improvements, more funding provided to it. It is an integral part of helping in domestic violence situations, helping with these shelters, working with women. It is so necessary. And if this act is not renewed, which is, as Sarah said, it will be September the 30th that it will come up for its renewal, a lot of these women in domestic violence situations are just going to feel this is another situation where the system is working against me and nobody is taking seriously what is going on out here.
I agree with Ellen. Without VAWA, I don't know what a lot of our programs will do. They have made a tremendous difference.
Can you give us an example of a program that's made a difference?
There's a lengthy list of what it's helped. A large portion of it, financially looking at it, helping funding programs. Without this sort of funding, organizations such as the one I work with wouldn't be out there. There wouldn't be these resources for the women in the community. They would have absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Sarah Catania, sure. Patty Prickett, the counselor, the subject of your article, the act allowed her to set up an office in a police precinct.
Yeah. That's right. And that was one of the points that I wanted to make, particularly going back to what Ellen, the comment that she made earlier about the suspicion and the fear that women in general have of the criminal justice system, of the police and the courts. And one of the things that the Violence Against Women Act has really tried to address with varying degrees of success, I think. I mean, the case that I of Patty Prickett in West L.A., in that case it was not particularly successful, but I'm sure that both other guests, Susan and Ellen, can talk about more successful examples where programs have been set up to work closely, where people who are intimately involved and familiar with how the domestic violence system works, how, you know, identifying victims, dealing with perpetrators, how they are linked directly. They're set up to work directly and intimately with the criminal justice system, with police departments, to try to bridge that gap, to try to help victims become more comfortable, to try to help the police understand better what to do when responding to domestic violence calls. The program that I wrote about, in that program, advocates actually went out with the police on domestic violence calls, went with them to, that really crucial moment when you're responding to that police call, when you get into that environment, how the police respond, and I'm sure Ellen and Susan can both remark on this, is so critical to what happens then in that case. Are they going to take it seriously? Are they going to address the woman as, are they going to be respectful to her? Are they going to address the man? Are they going to arrest him? How are they going to respond? Are they going to offer the woman services? How are they going to deal with that situation in a very tense environment? And from there forward, they then need to do follow-up with the woman. If she wants a restraining order, go with her to get that restraining order. Make sure that she and if there are children involved get into a safe environment. There's a lot of work there that needs to be done, and the Violence Against Women Act provides the kind of funding or has provided the kind of funding to enable those programs to move forward.
Hmm. What's the outlook for renewal?
I think it's mixed at this point. I haven't been following it on a day-to-day basis, but you know, the bills have been proposed in both the House and the Senate. The funding has been cut back repeatedly because of the tax cuts that have been made, the federal tax cuts and the war effort. I don't have up-to-date information. I don't know if Ellen or Susan might. It's not a particularly rosy picture, but it looks like something will happen. There is bipartisan support because it is a law and order type of bill, so it has appeal to both Democrats and Republicans. So that is one positive aspect of it.
Yeah, there's bipartisan support for the renewal in the Senate. Senate Bill 1197 is sponsored by Arlen Specter and Joe Biden. In the House, The House Bill 2876, sponsored by Representative Mark Green, a Republican of Wisconsin, and John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan. There's another bill in the House, 3171, sponsored by Representative Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat of California. And that, my information says, includes all the Senate and bipartisan House bill provisions and adds new and expanded programs and provisions. So I'm sure if people are listening this afternoon and are interested in this topic, they can find information online or at the library. Senate Bill 1197 and House Resolutions 2876 and 3171. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Today we're talking about addressing domestic violence. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have three guests with us this afternoon. Here with me in the studio, Susan Chapin and Ellen Schweitzer. Susan is the Domestic Violence Coordinator in the Office of the Champaign County State's Attorney. Ellen is a medical advocate with a Woman's Place, a shelter in Champaign-Urbana. With us on the phone this afternoon is a journalist who writes on criminal and social justice issues. Her name is Sarah Catania, and she is the author of an article on domestic violence, The Counselor, that appeared in the July-August issue of Mother Jones. And you can also find another article that she wrote in conjunction with this special issue of Mother Jones. That's the cover issue, the cover subject, domestic violence, of the July-August Mother Jones magazine. You can find another article that Sarah wrote online at MotherJones.com, is that right,
That's
Sarah?
Correct.
Okay, very good. I want to go back to the idea of, to the issue of children. Sarah, one of the things that you write about at the end of the article, our counselor, Patty Prickett, is in a high school setting working with kids. Tell us about that.
Yes, she after she left the police department, she got a job at a high school in Los Angeles, a public high school, actually one of the worst in terms of academic performance and violence and other factors. And she got a job there right on campus. There was some special funding set aside for that. And what she found was that domestic violence was one of the primary issues that she was dealing with there. Kids would, once she'd established relationships of trust with them, would reveal that they were witnessing domestic violence in the home, or that they were themselves involved in relationships, in violent relationships with other kids. I mentioned that earlier, with their partner, with their boyfriend or girlfriend. And so, sort of to her surprise, she continued her work in a very direct way with on the issue of domestic violence. If one of the students told her about witnessing domestic violence in the home, she was successful on several occasions in getting them to bring their mother in to talk to her directly so she could link them up with services and get them some kind of help. In the case of kids who were in violent relationships themselves, she was able to help them directly to try to deal with that, get out of the relationship, get the other, if the other kid went to the same school, get them in there and try and deal with the situation in that way. And statistics show that this is a major problem with kids in relationships that are abusive. So it's an area that is one of growing concern.
Yeah. Is there anything like that going on in our community, Ellen?
No, not that I'm aware of. And it's something that really needs to be out there with teen dating violence. It's very important not only to get parents involved, but to let these students know that there are resources out there for them, because this isn't something that discriminates age-wise. It's going to affect all ages, all incomes, all relationships. And I don't think that it's fair to just assume that domestic violence is taking place just in adult relationships. I don't think it's fair to teenagers, even younger students, even in the grade schools. I think it's important. I know we have advocates that will go out to schools and try and speak with the students, speak with the staff, but then again, there's a lot of hesitancy with that because of the stigma of domestic violence or the stigma of sexual assault, and it's something that they're maybe not quite sure if they want to introduce it to the children, if they think it might be more harmful to them than beneficial.
Mm. Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, addressing domestic violence, our topic, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now in Rantoul on line four. Hi.
Yes, I have one question. Why if women can get restraining orders, why is it that a father, husband can then, through the court system, set up, have visitation rights? And that's my question. Thank you.
Okay. Susan Chapin?
Visitation can be addressed in orders of protection, or they cannot be addressed in orders of protection. If there is visitation set up in some other type of – under some type of civil order, such as a divorce, then the judge usually defers it to that. But unless the petitioner in the order of protection specifically addresses visitation in the order of protection and in fact, you can get an order of protection without the stay-away part of the order. So it just depends on what is addressed in the order of protection.
Yeah. And the first caller we had this afternoon talked about a need that he saw for supervised visitation. Ellen, you want to address that?
Again, I think this is another frustration that these women might experience with the system. You know, if I'm filing this order of protection as a caller, I just called in and said, why, you know, is my abuser allowed, you know, visitation with these children? Again, that goes along with, as Susan had addressed, the remedies that these women can have on these orders of protection, which she might want to address that a little bit. I think, again, they feel that the system might be working against them. It's also an issue of, should the kids be in this situation? I've worked with many, many clients that have left an abusive situation and have left the children behind. And that's a huge, huge issue in these situations. The abuser knows that they can use the children almost as a pawn with the person they're abusing. The person who's being abused struggles with that because they may reach a point where they want to get help, but they don't know what to do for themselves. What should they do for their children? And the abuser's saying, fine, if you leave me, I'm going to keep the kids here. Or if you leave, I will find you and the children. And they will use that as a way to either get her to stay or keep her in that cycle of fear from her abuser.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener.
Before you go
sure.
to the listener, I just want to jump in very quickly and say that there's a documentary that's scheduled to air on PBS next month called Breaking the Silence, Children's Stories. And it's a documentary made by two filmmakers who have done other documentaries on domestic violence. And this one is specifically addressing the issue of children in domestic violence situations and custody issues. So if there are listeners who are interested in more information on that, that would be a good resource.
Okay, so check our listings for WILL-TV, our companion station, in September, that program. Okay, now let's go to a listener in Wellington. Line four, hi.
Hello. Is there still a program that you can send your old cell phones in for battered women? And if so, could I have a phone number or an address?
Okay, great question.
Yes, absolutely. This is a really important program for people involved in domestic violence situations. We do, at a Woman's Fund, accept cell phones. The importance of these for people who might be unaware of why she's asking this sort of question. We give these phones out to women. It allows them to dial 911 at any time, which is very important to them if they don't have access to a phone, if that's been restricted in their home. We do accept them. You can reach us at area code 217-384-4462, or you can stop by a Woman's Fund, which is at 1304 East Main Street in Urbana, just east of the courthouses.
Okay, very good. And I do think that there are places that you can leave off your cell phone, like at a mobile telephone store,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you might also check on that as well. Radio Shack, I think, will accept them, and I think also the Sprint stores will accept them as well. So if that would work for you as being more convenient, that's another way to go, I suppose. Caller on line four, are you still there? Did you want to follow up? No. Okay. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What, Sarah, I feel you want to jump in.
Yes, Celeste, I thought since you're giving out phone numbers, this might be a good time to give out a domestic violence hotline number. I'm sure that Ellen has one locally. There's also a national number. Ellen, did you want to give out a number women can call?
Absolutely. The local 24-hour line is area code 217-384-4390, and that is a 24-hour line. They can reach someone any time of night or day.
Okay, and the national number?
There's a national domestic violence hotline, and this would get a woman anywhere in the United States in touch with her local domestic violence hotline. That number is 1-800-799-SAFE, which is 1-800-799-7233.
Okay. You know, the nationwide hotline number, I'm really glad you mentioned that, Sarah, because, you know, I'm thinking now of rural women and, that, you know, here we've got another layer of isolation. Anybody want to pick up that topic and address it?
We see that a lot in the rural communities. That is a more form of isolation. It gets battered women away from their families, away from their friends. And oftentimes when they get to our office, I just had a victim tell me the other day, and we worked with her for over 2 years, that she doesn't have one friend to her name because in all the years she was with her abuser, she never was allowed to have friends. So if they can get them into rural areas, it's so much easier. And if they don't have transportation, and a lot of times they don't allow the victims to have a driver's license, if they don't have a telephone or they only have a cell phone and he takes it with him when he leaves the house. So there's all types of isolation. But we see a lot of the rural area in this county.
Hmm. Ellen?
I completely agree with Susan. It's a very large problem. It's a population out there that it's difficult to get resources to them, to have them reach out. This is a main tool that abusers will use in a domestic violence situation is isolation, as Susan said. Restricting her from having friends, restricting her from working, contact with her family. That is another tool used that they will go after her family if they don't refuse contact with them. In rural areas, it's very difficult. As Susan was saying, they don't necessarily have a shelter that's down the street from them. They don't have a neighbor that maybe they can set up a safety plan with. They don't have friends. It's a huge, huge problem, and I think it's especially important for programs, domestic violence and sexual assault programs, to reach out into these rural areas and let them know that services are available to them, just the same as somebody living, say, just immediately in the Champaign-Urbana area.
Yeah. Sarah, any thoughts?
I just concur in terms of everyone I've talked to in my reporting for this piece, that what they're saying is absolutely true, not just in the Champaign-Urbana area, but around the country, that obviously in rural areas it's harder to get access to services, but women who find themselves in these situations should be persistent and know that those services are available. They just might have to try a little harder to find them.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're coming down here to the last minute or two of the program this afternoon. Again, I want to mention the Violence Against Women Act. If that's something you would like to support, I'm sure your lawmaker would be interested in hearing from you, and I'm sure it's something my three guests this afternoon would applaud. Before we wrap up here, any thoughts about, in terms of from where the three of you sit, what could we do? What could we do better? What else could we do?
I think education, public education. With public education, we're not only educating our victims, but we're also educating our jury pools. I think we have to get out there. Any opportunity we get to speak to any groups, if we can get into schools, and I kind of wanted to address that when Ellen was talking about it, it's very difficult to get into the school system with a domestic violence program. But we need to start with the younger kids and just education all the way around.
Okay. Ellen is agreeing?
Yeah, I 100% agree. It's education. Education with law enforcement personnel, education with the general population, education with people working in hospitals and emergency settings. It's very, very important. Education is out there. Programs such as the one I work with are readily available to come out and educate schools, hospitals, law enforcement. The tools are there for them to use, and it's just extremely important that we spread the education around.
And Sarah Catania?
Yes, I agree with everything Ellen and Susan just said.
And there's a lot of education to be done. Sarah, one of the things I was really struck by is that you talked with a retired judge who told you about what can happen in a courtroom when a case comes before a judge. You want to just briefly tell us the anecdote?
Sure. This judge who actually, what he does now that he's retired, is he goes around holding educational seminars for judges, because it's not just the public that needs to get, the general public that needs to get educated or be educated, but also judges and prosecutors and police officers. So he goes around the country trying to help judges understand the law on domestic violence. And in one particular instance, he had a bunch of judges, and he was asking them, getting them some information, and gave them an exercise to perform, a puzzle to solve, about a woman coming to them who was a victim of domestic violence, and she had taken out a restraining order in one state but had moved to another, and the perpetrator had followed her to the other state and violated that protection order. And most of the judges did not know that under the Violence Against Women Act, that woman was protected in the other state, that she did not have to take out an additional restraining order. So that very basic piece of information was not something that most of the judges who had sought out this conference knew.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. I want to thank our guests very much this afternoon for joining us here on the Afternoon Magazine. On the phone with us this afternoon has been Sarah Catania. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In the studio with me, Susan Chapin of the Champaign County State's Attorney's Office, and Ellen Schweitzer with A Woman's Place, a shelter in Champaign-Urbana. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
It is 7 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. And I think we're going to talk with Jay Pierce this afternoon.
That's right, Celeste. Thank you very much. And on the Chicago Board of Trade today, September wheat had a high of 318, a low of 311 and a quarter, settled at 314, down 3 and a quarter. December had a high of 332 and a half, a low of 325 and three quarters. The settlement was 328 and a half, down 3. March corn, 344 and a half was the high. The low was 338 and a quarter. The settlement, 341 and a quarter, down 3 and a quarter. May, 350 for the high. 344 and a half was the low. The settlement, 346 and a half, down 3 and a half. And July, 06 wheat at a high of 354, a low of 347 and three quarters. The settlement, 350, down 2 and three quarters. September corn had a high of 211, a low of 208 and a quarter. The settlement, 208 and three quarters, down 1 and three quarters. December also down 1 and three quarters. The high today, 224 and a half. The low, 221 and three quarters. The settlement, 221. Make that 222 and a quarter again, down 1 and three quarters. March 06, the high today, 233 and three quarters. The low, 231 and a half. The settlement, 232 even, down 1 and a half. May corn, 239 and a quarter was the high. The low was 237 and three quarters. The settlement, 238 and a quarter, down three quarters. July 06 had a high of 244 and a half, a low of 242. The settlement, 242 and a half, down 1 and a quarter. And way out into September 06, the high today, 248, low 247, settlement 247 unchanged. September oats had a high of 151 and a half, a low of 149 and a half. The settlement 151 and a quarter, up 1 and a quarter. And December also closed up 1 and a quarter. The high today 160 and a half, low is 157 and a half. Settlement 160 and a quarter, up 1 and 1 quarter. Under the soybean pit, the September beans had a high of 611, a low of 602, the settlement 602 and a half, down 8 and a quarter. November had a high of 621 and a half, a low of 611 and a half, the settlement 612 and three quarters, down 7 and three quarters. January soybeans hit a high of 628, a low of 619, the settlement 619 and three quarters, down 6 and a quarter. March 06 soybeans had a high of 631 and a half, a low of 624. The settlement was 625 and a half, down 5 and a half. May 06 beans, high 633, the low 625, the settlement 625 and a half, down 7. And July 06 soybeans had a high of 637, a low of 630. The settlement was 630 and a half, down 6 on the day. Soybean meal for September had a high at 190.50, a low of 187.50, the settlement 188.30, down 170. And October soybean meal had a high of 191, a low of 188.20. Settlement was 188.60, down 190. Soybean oil, the high for September contract, 22.56, low is 22.41, the settlement 22.50, down 6. And October soybean oil had a high of 22.67, the low is 22.50, the settlement 22.59, down 7. Now for a look at how things settled on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, back to you, Celeste.
Okay, let's take a look at what happened today on the Merc. August feeder cattle, the high price today, 111.40, the low 111.20, the settlement 111.30, up 15. September, 109.65, the high 109.20, the low 109.45, the settlement, that up 30. October, 108.50, the high, the low 107.90, the settlement 108 even, that up 15. August live cattle, 81.25, the high 80.52.5, the low, the settlement 81.05, that up 50. October 82.10, the high 81.55, the low 82 even, the settlement that up 37.5. October lean hog 62.20, the high 61.30, the low 61.80, the settlement that up 12.5. December 59.55, the high 58.85, the low 59.45, the settlement that down 12.5. February 60.95, the high 60.05, the low settlement that up 12.5. April lean hog 60.20, the high 59.70, the low, the settlement 60.12.5, that down 22.5. And August pork belly 70.20 was the high today, the low 69.80, the settlement 69.95, that finishing 20 higher. Let's take a look now at what's happening on Wall Street. The Dow is off 24 points at 10,496. The NASDAQ 7 higher at 2144. And the S&P 500 off a point at 1217.
It's time once again to Ask for Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Mikey Wallen from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, writes, Dear Dr. Science, I'm so confused. What exactly is the difference between handcuffs and fisticuffs?
Handcuffs are used after fisticuffs north of the equator. In the southern hemisphere, that order is reversed, and fisticuffs erupt only after the participants are first handcuffed. At the equator itself, well, everyone suspected of possibly instigating a violent act is immediately put into a straitjacket and then thrown into a room padded with banana leaves and old newspapers. Years of this sort of social conditioning prove a partial explanation for the relative instability of governments in equatorial climes. Other reasons might be biting fleas and what the humidity does to your hair.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions.